manuscript stacked on the fiction editor's desk. Within the hour, there would be 60, crowding each other onto the floor. And in a year? I smiled, seeing a pristine, imaginary manuscript floating in midair, with Esther Greenwood typed in the upper right-hand corner. After my month on the magazine, I'd applied for a summer school course with a famous writer where you sent in the manuscript of a story and he read it and said whether you were good enough to be admitted into his class. Of course, it was a very small class, and I had sent in my story a long time ago and hadn't heard from the writer yet, but I was sure I'd find the letter of acceptance waiting on the mail table at home. I decided I'd surprise JC and send in a couple of stories I wrote in this class under a pseudonym. Then one day the fiction editor would come into JC personally and plop the stories down on her desk and say, "Here's something a cut above the usual." And JC would agree and accept them and ask the author to lunch, and it would be me. "Honestly," Doreen said, "this one'll be different." "Tell me about him," I said stonily. "He's from Peru." "They're squat," I said. "They're ugly as Aztecs." "No, no, no, sweetie. I've already met him." We were sitting on my bed in a mess of dirty cotton dresses and laddered nylons and gray underwear, and for 10 minutes Doreen had been trying to persuade me to go to a country club dance with a friend of somebody Lenny knew, which, she insisted, was a very different thing from a friend of Lenny's. But as I was catching the 8 o'clock train home the next morning, I felt I should make some attempt to pack. I also had a dim idea that if I walked the streets of New York by myself all night, something of the city's mystery and magnificence might rub off onto me at last. But I gave it up. It was becoming more and more difficult for me to decide to do anything in those last days. And when I eventually did decide to do something, such as packing a suitcase, I only dragged all my grubby, expensive clothes out of the bureau and the closet and spread them on the chairs and the bed and the floor and then sat and stared at them, utterly perplexed. They seemed to have a separate, mulish identity of their own that refused to be washed and folded and stowed. "It's these clothes," I told Doreen. "I just can't face these clothes when I come back." "That's easy." And in her beautiful one-track way, Doreen started to snatch up slips and stockings in the elaborate strapless bra full of steel springs, a free gift from the Primrose Corset Company, which I'd never had the courage to wear. And finally, one by one, the sad array of queerly cut $40 dresses. "Hey, leave that one out. I'm wearing it." Doreen extricated a black scrap from her bundle and dropped it in my lap. Then, snowballing the rest of the clothes into one soft conglomerate mass, she stuffed them out of sight under the bed. Doreen knocked on the green door with the gold knob. Scuffling and a man's laugh, cut short, sounded from inside. Then a tall boy in shirt sleeves and a blonde crew cut inched the door open and peered out. "Baby," he roared. Doreen disappeared in his arms. I thought it must be the person Lenny knew. I stood quietly in the doorway in my black sheath and my black stole with the fringe, yellower than ever, but expecting less. "I am an observer," I told myself, as I watched Doreen being handed into the room by the blonde boy to another man who was also tall but dark, with slightly longer hair. This man was wearing an immaculate white suit, a pale blue shirt, and a yellow satin tie with a bright stick pin. I couldn't take my eyes off that stick pin. A great white light seemed to shoot out of it, illuminating the room. Then the light withdrew into itself, leaving a dewdrop on the field of gold. I put one foot in front of the other. "That's a diamond," somebody said, and a lot of people burst out laughing. My nail tapped a glassy facet. "Her first diamond. Give it to her, Marco." Marco bowed and deposited the stick pin in my palm. It dazzled and danced with light like a heavenly ice cube. I slipped it quickly into my imitation jet bead evening bag and looked around. The faces were empty as plates, and nobody seemed to be breathing. Fortunately, a dry, hard hand encircled my upper arm. I am escorting the lady for the rest of the evening. Perhaps, the spark in Marco's eyes extinguished and they went black, I shall perform some small service, somebody laughed, worthy of a diamond. The hand round my arm tightened. Ouch. Marco removed his hand. I looked down at my arm. A thumbprint purpled into view. Marco watched me. Then he pointed to the underside of my arm. Look there. I looked and saw 4 faint matching prints. You see, I am quite serious. Marco's small, flickering smile reminded me of a snake I'd teased in the Bronx Zoo. When I tapped my finger on the stout cage glass, the snake had opened its clockwork jaws and seemed to smile. Then it struck and struck and struck at the invisible pane till I moved off. I had never met a woman-hater before. I could tell Marco was a woman-hater because in spite of all the models and TV starlets in the room that night, he paid attention to nobody but me. Not out of kindness or even curiosity, but because I'd happened to be dealt to him, like a playing card in a pack of identical cards. A man in the country club band stepped up to the mic and started shaking those seed pod rattles that mean South American music. Marco reached for my hand, but I hung on to my 4th daiquiri and stayed put. I'd never had a daiquiri before. The reason I had a daiquiri was because Marco ordered it for me, and I felt so grateful he hadn't asked what sort of drink I wanted that I didn't say a word, I just drank one daiquiri after another. Marco looked at me. No, I said. What do you mean, no? I can't dance to that kind of music. Don't be stupid. I want to sit here and finish my drink. Marco bent toward me with a tight smile, and in one scoop, my drink took wing and landed in a potted palm. Then Marco gripped my hand in such a way I had to choose between following him onto the dance floor or having my arm torn off. It's a tango. Marco maneuvered me out among the dancers. I love tangos. I can't dance. You don't have to dance. I'll do the dancing. Marco hooked an arm around my waist and jerked me up against his dazzling white suit. Then he said, "Pretend you are drowning." I shut my eyes and the music broke over me like a rainstorm. Marco's leg slid forward against mine and my leg slid back, and I seemed to be riveted to him, limb for limb, moving as he moved without any will or knowledge of my own. And after a while I thought, it doesn't take 2 to dance, it only takes 1. And I let myself blow and bend like a tree in the wind. What did I tell you? Marco's breath scorched my ear. You're a perfectly respectable dancer. I began to see why women haters could make such fools of women. Women haters were like gods, invulnerable and chock full of power. They descended and then they disappeared. You could never catch one. After the South American music, there was an interval. Marco led me through the French doors into the garden. Lights and voices spilled from the ballroom window, but a few yards beyond, the darkness drew up its barricade and sealed them off. In the infinitesimal glow of the stars, the trees and flowers were strewing their cool odors. There was no moon. The box hedges shut behind us. A deserted golf course stretched away toward a few hilly clumps of trees, and I felt the whole desolate familiarity of the scene, the country club and the dance and the lawn with its single cricket. I didn't know where I was, but it was somewhere in the wealthy suburbs of New York. Marco produced a slim cigar and a silver lighter in the shape of a bullet. He set the cigar between his lips and bent over the small flare. His face, with its exaggerated shadows and planes of light, looked alien and pained, like a refugee's. I watched him. "Who are you in love with?" I said then. For a minute, Marco didn't say anything. He simply opened his mouth and breathed out a blue vaporous ring. "Perfect," he laughed. The ring widened and blurred, ghost pale in the dark air. "Ben," he said, "I am in love with my cousin." I felt no surprise. "Why don't you marry her?" "Impossible," Why? Mirko shrugged. She's my first cousin. She's going to be a nun. Is she beautiful? There's no one to touch her. Does she know you love her? Of course. I paused. The obstacle seemed unreal to me. If you love her, I said, you'll love somebody else someday. Mirko dashed his cigar underfoot. The ground soared and struck me with a soft shock. Mud squirmed through my fingers. Mirko waited until I half rose. Then he put both hands on my shoulders and flung me back. My dress. Your dress. The mud oozed and adjusted itself to my shoulder blades. Your dress. Mirko's face lowered cloudily over mine. A few drops of spit struck my lips. Your dress is black, and the dirt is black as well. Then he threw himself face down as if he would grind his body through me and into the mud. It's happening, I thought. It's happening. If I just lie here and do nothing, it will happen. Mirko set his teeth to the strap at my shoulder and tore my sheath to the waist. I saw the glimmer of bare skin, like a pale veil separating two bloody-minded adversaries. Slut. The word hissed in my ear. Slut. The dust cleared, and I had a full view of the battle. I began to writhe and bite. Mirko weighed me to the earth. Slut. I gouged at his leg with the sharp heel of my shoe. He turned, fumbling for the hurt. Then I fisted my fingers together and smashed them at his nose. It was like hitting the steel plate of a battleship. Mirko sat up. I began to cry. Mirko pulled out a white handkerchief and dabbed his nose. Blackness, like ink, spread over the pale cloth. I sucked at my salty knuckles. I want Doreen. Mirko stared off across the golf links. I want Doreen. I want to go home. Sluts, all sluts. Mirko seemed to be talking to himself. Yes or no, it is all the same. I poked Marco's shoulder. Where's Doreen? Mirko snorted. Go to the parking lot. Look in the backs of all the cars. Then he spun around. My diamond. I got up and retrieved my stole from the darkness. I started to walk off. Mirko sprang to his feet and blocked my path. Then, deliberately, he wiped his finger under the bloody nose and with two strokes stained my cheeks. I have earned my diamond with this blood. Give it to me. I don't know where it is. Now I knew perfectly well that the diamond was in my evening bag, and that when Mirko had knocked me down, my evening bag had soared, like a night bird, into the enveloping darkness. I began to think I would lead him away and then return on my own and hunt for it. I had no idea what a diamond that size would buy, but whatever it was, I knew it would be a lot. Mirko took my shoulders in both hands. Tell me, he said, giving each word equal emphasis. Tell me, or I'll break your neck. Suddenly, I didn't care. It's in my imitation jet bead evening bag, I said, somewhere in the muck. I left Mirko on his hands and knees, scrabbling in the darkness for another, smaller darkness that hid the light of his diamond from his furious eyes. Doreen was not in the ballroom, nor in the parking lot. I kept to the fringe of the shadows so nobody would notice the grass plastered to my dress and shoes, and with my black stole I covered my shoulders and bare breasts. Luckily for me, the dance was nearly over, and groups of people were leaving and coming out to the parked cars. I asked at one car after another until finally I found a car that had room and would drop me in the middle of Manhattan. At that vague hour between dark and dawn, the sunroof of the Amazon was deserted. Quiet as a burglar in my cornflower-sprigged bathrobe, I crept to the edge of the parapet. The parapet reached almost to my shoulders, so I dragged a folding chair from the stack against the wall and opened it, and climbed into the precarious seat. A stiff breeze lifted the hair from my head. At my feet, the city doused its lights in sleep, its buildings blackened as if for a funeral. It was my last night. I grasped the bundle I carried and pulled at a pale tail. A strapless, elasticized slip, which, in the course of wear, had lost its elasticity, slumped into my hand. I waved it like a flag of truce, once, twice. The breeze caught it and I let go. A white flake floated out into the night and began its slow descent. I wondered on what street or rooftop it would come to rest. I tugged at the bundle again. The wind made an effort but failed, and a bat-like shadow sank toward the roof garden of the penthouse opposite. Piece by piece, I fed my wardrobe to the night wind, and flutteringly, like a loved one's ashes, the gray scraps were ferried off to settle here, there, exactly where I would never know. In the dark heart of New York. The face in the mirror looked like a sick Indian. I dropped the compact into my pocketbook and stared out of the train window. Like a colossal junkyard, the swamps and back lots of Connecticut flashed past, one broken down fragment bearing no relation to another. What a hodgepodge the world was. I glanced down at my unfamiliar skirt and blouse. The skirt was a green dirndl with tiny black, white, and electric blue shapes swarming across it, and it stuck out like a lampshade. Instead of sleeves, the white eyelet blouse had frills at the shoulder, floppy as the wings of a new angel. I'd forgotten to save any day clothes from the ones I let fly over New York, so Betsy had traded me a blouse and skirt for my bathrobe with the cornflowers on it. A wan reflection of myself, white wings, brown ponytail and all, ghosted over the landscape. "Pollyanna cowgirl," I said out loud. A woman in the seat opposite looked up from her magazine. I hadn't, at the last moment, felt like washing off the two diagonal lines of dried blood that marked my cheeks. They seemed touching and rather spectacular. And I thought I would carry them around with me like the relic of a dead lover till they wore off of their own accord. Of course, if I smiled or moved my face much, the blood would flake away in no time, so I kept my face immobile, and when I had to speak, I spoke through my teeth without disturbing my lips. I didn't really see why people should look at me. Plenty of people looked queerer than I did. My gray suitcase rode on the rack over my head, empty except for the 30 best short stories of the year, a white plastic sunglasses case, and 24 avocado pears, a parting present from Doreen. The pears were unripe, so they would keep well, and whenever I lifted my suitcase up or down or simply carried it along, they cannoned from one end to the other with a special little thunder of their own.
Route 128!
The conductor bawled. The domesticated wilderness of pine, maple, and oak rolled to a halt and stuck in the frame of the train window like a bad picture. My suitcase grumbled and bumped as I negotiated the long aisle. I stepped from the air-conditioned compartment onto the station platform, and the motherly breath of the suburbs enfolded me. It smelt of lawn sprinklers and station wagons and tennis rackets and dogs and babies. A summer calm laid its soothing hand over everything, like death. My mother was waiting by the glove-gray Chevrolet.
"Why, lovey, what's happened to your face?"
"Cut myself," I said briefly, and crawled into the back seat after my suitcase. I didn't want her staring at me the whole way home. The upholstery felt slippery and clean. My mother climbed behind the wheel and tossed a few letters into my lap, then turned her back. The car purred into life. "I think I should tell you right away," she said, and I could see bad news in the set of her neck. "You didn't make that writing course." The air punched out of my stomach. All through June, the writing course had stretched before me like a bright, safe bridge over the dull gulf of summer. Now I saw it totter and dissolve, and a body in a white blouse and green skirt plummeted into the gap. Then my mouth shaped itself sourly. I had expected it. I slunk down on the middle of my spine, my nose level with the rim of the window, and watched the houses of outer Boston glide by. As the houses grew more familiar, I slunk still lower. I felt it was very important not to be recognized. The gray, padded car roof closed over my head like the roof of a prison van, and the white, shining, identical clapboard houses with their interstices of well-groomed green proceeded past, one bar after another, in a large but escape-proof cage. I had never spent a summer in the suburbs before. The soprano squeak of carriage wheels punished my ear. Sun seeping through the blinds filled the bedroom with a sulfurous light. I didn't know how long I had slept, but I felt one big twitch of exhaustion. The twin bed next to mine was empty and unmade. At 7, I heard my mother get up, slip into her clothes, and tiptoe out of the room. Then the buzz of the orange squeezer sounded from downstairs, and the smell of coffee and bacon filtered under my door. Then the sink water ran from the tap and dishes clinked as my mother dried them and put them back in the cupboard. Then the front door opened and shut, then the car door opened and shut, and the motor went broom, broom, and, edging off with a crunch of gravel, faded into the distance. My mother was teaching shorthand and typing to a lot of city college girls and wouldn't be home till the middle of the afternoon. The carriage wheels squeaked past again. Somebody seemed to be wheeling a baby back and forth under my window. I slipped out of bed and onto the rug, and quietly, on my hands and knees, crawled over to see who it was. Ours was a small white clapboard house set in the middle of a small green lawn on the corner of two peaceful suburban streets. But in spite of the little maple trees planted at intervals around our property, anybody passing along the sidewalk could glance up at the second-story windows and see just what was going on. This was brought home to me by our next-door neighbor, a spiteful woman named Mrs. Ockenden. Mrs. Ockenden was a retired nurse who had just married her third husband. The other two had died in curious circumstances, and she spent an inordinate amount of time peering from behind the starched white curtains of her windows. She had called my mother up twice about me, once to report that I had been sitting in front of the house for an hour under the streetlight and kissing somebody in a blue Plymouth, and once to say that I had better pull the blinds down in my room because she had seen me half-naked getting ready for bed one night when she happened to be out walking her Scotch terrier. With great care, I raised my eyes to the level of the windowsill. A woman, not 5 feet tall, with a grotesque, protruding stomach, was wheeling an old black baby carriage down the street. Two or three small children of various sizes, all pale with smudgy faces and bare, smudgy knees, wobbled along in the shadow of her skirts. A serene, almost religious smile lit up the woman's face. Her head tilted happily back, like a sparrow egg perched on a duck egg, she smiled into the sun. I knew the woman well. It was Dodo Conway. Dodo Conway was a Catholic who'd gone to Barnard and then married an architect who'd gone to Columbia and was also Catholic. They had a big rambling house up the street from us, set behind a morbid facade of pine trees and surrounded by scooters, tricycles, doll carriages, toy fire trucks, baseball bats, badminton nets, croquet wickets, hamster cages, and cocker spaniel puppies. The whole sprawling paraphernalia of suburban childhood. Dodo interested me in spite of myself. Her house was unlike all the others in our neighborhood in its size. It was much bigger. And its color. The second story was constructed of dark brown clapboard and the first of gray stucco studded with gray and purple golf ball-shaped stones. And the pine trees completely screened it from view, which was considered unsociable in our community of adjoining lawns and friendly waist-high hedges. Dodo raised her 6 children and would no doubt raise her 7th on Rice Krispies, peanut butter and marshmallow sandwiches, vanilla ice cream, and gallon upon gallon of Hood's milk. She got a special discount from the local milkman. Everybody loved Dodo, although the swelling size of her family was the talk of the neighborhood. The older people around, like my mother, had 2 children, and the younger, more prosperous ones had 4, but nobody but Dodo was on the verge of a 7th. Even 6 was considered excessive, but then everybody said, of course, Dodo was a Catholic. I watched Dodo wheel the youngest Conway up and down. She seemed to be doing it for my benefit. Children made me sick. A floorboard creaked, and I ducked down again just as Dodo Conway's face, by instinct or some gift of supernatural hearing, turned on the little pivot of its neck. I felt her gaze pierce through the white clapboard and the pink wallpaper roses and uncover me, crouching there behind the silver pickets of the radiator. I crawled back into bed and pulled the sheet over my head, but even that didn't shut out the light, so I buried my head under the darkness of the pillow and pretended it was night. I couldn't see the point of getting up. I had nothing to look forward to. After a while, I heard the telephone ringing in the downstairs hall. I stuffed the pillow into my ears and gave myself 5 minutes. Then I lifted my head from its bolt hole. The ringing had stopped. Almost at once, it started up again. Cursing whatever friend, relative, or stranger had sniffed out my homecoming, I padded barefoot downstairs. The black instrument on the hall table trilled its hysterical note over and over like a nervous bird. I picked up the receiver. "Hello?" I said in a low, disguised voice. "Hello? Esther? What's the matter? Have you got laryngitis?" It was my old friend Jody calling from Cambridge. Jody was working at the Coop that summer and taking a lunchtime course in sociology. She and 2 other girls from my college had rented a big apartment with 4 Harvard Law students, and I'd been planning to move in with them when my writing course began. Jody wanted to know when they could expect me. "I'm not coming," I said. "I didn't make the course." There was a small pause. "He's an ass," Jody said then. "He doesn't know a good thing when he sees it." "My sentiments exactly." My voice sounded strange and hollow in my ears. "Come anyway, take some other course." The notion of studying German or abnormal psychology flitted through my head. After all, I'd saved nearly the whole of my New York salary, so I could just about afford it. But the hollow voice said, "You better count me out." "Well," Jody began, "there's this other girl who wanted to come in with us if anybody dropped out." "Fine, ask her." The minute I hung up, I knew I should have said I would come. One more morning listening to Dodo Conway's baby carriage would drive me crazy. And I made a point of never living in the same house with my mother for more than a week. I reached for the receiver. My hand advanced a few inches, then retreated and fell limp. I forced it toward the receiver again, but again it stopped short, as if it had collided with a pane of glass. I wandered into the dining room. Propped on the table, I found a long, business-like letter from the summer school and a thin blue letter on leftover Yale stationery addressed to me in Buddy Willard's lucid hand. I slid open the summer school letter with a knife. Since I wasn't accepted for the writing course, it said I could choose some other course instead, but I should call into the admissions office that same morning or it would be too late to register. The courses were almost full. I dialed the admissions office and listened to the zombie voice leave a message that Miss Esther Greenwood was canceling all arrangements to come to summer school. Then I opened Buddy Willard's letter. Buddy wrote that he was probably falling in love with a nurse who also had TB, but his mother had rented a cottage in the Adirondacks for the month of July, and if I came along with her, he might well find his feeling for the nurse was a mere infatuation. I snatched up a pencil and crossed out Buddy's message. Then I turned the letter paper over and on the opposite side wrote that I was engaged to a simultaneous interpreter and never wanted to see Buddy again as I did not want to give my children a hypocrite for a father. I stuck the letter back in the envelope, scotch-taped it together, and readdressed it to Buddy without putting on a new stamp. I thought the message was worth a good 3 cents.
Then I decided I would spend the summer writing a novel. That would fix a lot of people. I strolled into the kitchen, dropped a raw egg into a teacup of raw hamburger, mixed it up and ate it. Then I set up the card table on the screened breezeway between the house and the garage. A great wallowing bush of mock orange shut off the view from the street in front. The house wall and the garage wall took care of either side, and a clump of birches and a box hedge protected me from Mrs. Ockenden at the back. I counted out 350 sheets of Corrasible Bond from my mother's stock in the hall closet, secreted away under a pile of old felt hats and clothes brushes and woolen scarves. Back on the breezeway, I fed the first virgin sheet into my old portable and rolled it up. From another distanced mind, I saw myself sitting on the breezeway, surrounded by two white clappered walls, a mock orange bush, and a clump of birches and a box hedge, small as a doll in a doll's house. A feeling of tenderness filled my heart. My heroine would be myself, only in disguise. She would be called Elaine. Elaine. I counted the letters on my fingers. There were 6 letters in Esther, too. It seemed a lucky thing. Elaine sat on the breezeway in an old yellow nightgown of her mother's, waiting for something to happen. It was a sweltering morning in July, and drops of sweat crawled down her back one by one like slow insects. I leaned back and read what I had written. It seemed lively enough, and I was quite proud of the bit about the drops of sweat like insects, only I had the dim impression I'd probably read it somewhere else a long time ago. I sat like that for about an hour, trying to think what would come next, and in my mind, the barefoot doll in her mother's old yellow nightgown sat and stared into space as well.
"Why, honey, don't you want to get dressed?"
My mother took care never to tell me to do anything. She would only reason with me sweetly, like one intelligent, mature person with another. "It's almost 3 in the afternoon." "I'm writing a novel," I said. "I haven't got time to change out of this and change into that." I lay on the couch on the breezeway and shut my eyes. I could hear my mother clearing the typewriter and the papers from the card table and laying out the silver for supper, but I didn't move. Inertia oozed like molasses through Elaine's limbs. "That's what it must feel like to have malaria," she thought. "At that rate, I'd be lucky if I wrote a page a day." Then I knew what the trouble was. I needed experience. How could I write about life when I'd never had a love affair or a baby or even seen anybody die? A girl I knew had just won a prize for a short story about her adventures among the pygmies in Africa. How could I compete with that sort of thing? By the end of supper, my mother had convinced me I should study shorthand in the evenings. Then I would be killing 2 birds with 1 stone, writing a novel and learning something practical as well. I would also be saving a whole lot of money. That same evening, my mother unearthed an old blackboard from the cellar and set it up on the breezeway. Then she stood at the blackboard and scribbled little curlicues in white chalk while I sat in a chair and watched. At first, I felt hopeful. I thought I might learn shorthand in no time, and when the freckled lady at the scholarship's office asked me why I hadn't worked to earn money in July and August the way you were supposed to if you were a scholarship girl, I could tell her I had taken a free shorthand course instead so I could support myself right after college. The only thing was, when I tried to picture myself in some job, briskly jotting down line after line of shorthand, my mind went blank. There wasn't one job I felt like doing where you used shorthand. And as I sat there and watched, the white chalk curlicues blurred into senselessness. I told my mother I had a terrible headache and went to bed. An hour later, the door inched open and she crept into the room. I heard the whisper of her clothes as she undressed. She climbed into bed. Then her breathing grew slow and regular. In the dim light of the street lamp that filtered through the drawn blinds, I could see the pin curls on her head glittering like a row of little bayonets.
I decided I would put off the novel until I had gone to Europe and had a lover, and that I would never learn a word of shorthand. If I never learned shorthand, I would never have to use it. I thought I would spend the summer reading Finnegan's Wake and writing my thesis. Then I would be way ahead when college started at the end of September, and able to enjoy my last year instead of swatting away with no makeup and stringy hair on a diet of coffee and Benzedrine the way most seniors taking honors did until they finished their thesis. Then I thought I might put off college for a year and apprentice myself to a pottery maker, or work my way to Germany to be a waitress until I was bilingual. Then plan after plan started leaping through my head like a family of scatty rabbits. I saw the years of my life spaced along a road in the form of telephone poles, threaded together by wires. I counted 1, 2, 3, 19 telephone poles. And then the wires dangled into space. And try as I would, I couldn't see a single pole beyond the 19th. The room blued into view, and I wondered where the night had gone. My mother turned from a foggy log into a slumbering middle-aged woman, her mouth slightly open and a snore raveling from her throat. The piggish noise irritated me, and for a while it seemed to me that the only way to stop it would be to take the column of skin and sinew from which it rose and twist it to silence between my hands. I feigned sleep until my mother left for school. But even my eyelids didn't shut out the light. They hung the raw red screen of their tiny vessels in front of me like a wound. I crawled between the mattress and the padded bedstead and let the mattress fall across me like a tombstone. It felt dark and safe under there. But the mattress was not heavy enough. It needed about a ton more weight to make me sleep. River run past Eve and Adams. From swerve of shore to bend of bay, brings us by a commodious vicus of recirculation back to Howth Castle and environs. The thick book made an unpleasant dent in my stomach. River run past Eve and Adams. I thought the small letter at the start might mean that nothing ever really began new, with a capital, but that it just flowed on from what came before. Eve and Adams was Adam and Eve, of course, but it probably signified something else as well. Maybe it was a pub in Dublin. My eyes sank through an alphabet soup of letters to the long word in the middle of the page. Ba 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 dal garag ta kaminarong con bron ton neron truon thun trovar huan nauskan tu hu hur den en thur nuk. I counted the letters. There were exactly 100 of them. I thought this must be important. Why should there be 100 letters? Haltingly, I tried the word aloud. It sounded like a heavy wooden object falling downstairs, boomp, 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 step after step. Lifting the pages of the book, I let them fan slowly by my eyes. Words, dimly familiar but twisted all awry, like faces in a funhouse mirror, fled past, leaving no impression on the glassy surface of my brain. I squinted at the page. The letters grew barbs and ram's horns. I watched them separate, each from the other, and jiggle up and down in a silly way. Then they associated themselves in fantastic, untranslatable shapes like Arabic or Chinese. I decided to junk my thesis. I decided to junk the whole honors program and become an ordinary English major. I went to look up the requirements of an ordinary English major at my college. There were a lot of requirements, and I didn't have half of them. One of the requirements was a course in the 18th century. I hated the very idea of the 18th century, with all those smug men writing tight little couplets and being so dead keen on reason. So I'd skipped it. They let you do that in honors. You were much freer. I'd been so free, I'd spent most of my time on Dylan Thomas. A friend of mine, also in honors, had managed never to read a word of Shakespeare, but she was a real expert on the four quartets. I saw how impossible and embarrassing it would be for me to try to switch from my free program into the stricter one, so I looked up the requirements for English majors at the City College where my mother taught. They were even worse. You had to know Old English and the history of the English language, and a representative selection of all that had been written from Beowulf to the present day. This surprised me. I had always looked down on my mother's college, as it was co-ed and filled with people who couldn't get scholarships to the big Eastern colleges. Now I saw that the stupidest person at my mother's college knew more than I did. I saw they wouldn't even let me in through the door, let alone give me a large scholarship like the one I had at my own college. I thought I'd better go to work for a year and think things over. Maybe I could study the 18th century in secret. But I didn't know shorthand, so what could I do? I could be a waitress or a typist, but I couldn't stand the idea of being either one. You say you want more sleeping pills? Yes, but the ones I gave you last week are very strong. They don't work anymore. Teresa's large, dark eyes regarded me thoughtfully. I could hear the voices of her three children in the garden under the consulting room window. My Aunt Libby had married an Italian, and Teresa was my aunt's sister-in-law and our family doctor. I liked Teresa. She had a gentle, intuitive touch. I thought it must be because she was Italian. There was a little pause. "What seems to be the matter?" Teresa said then. "I can't sleep. I can't read." I tried to speak in a cool, calm way, but the zombie rose up in my throat and choked me off. I turned my hands palm up. "I think..." Teresa tore off a white slip from her prescription pad and wrote down a name and address. "You'd better see another doctor I know. He'll be able to help you more than I can." I peered at the writing, but I couldn't read it. "Dr. Gordon," Teresa said. "He's a psychiatrist." Dr. Gordon's waiting room was hushed in beige. The walls were beige, and the carpets were beige, and the upholstered chairs and sofas were beige. There were no mirrors or pictures, only certificates from different medical schools with Dr. Gordon's name in Latin hung about the walls. Pale green loopy ferns and spiked leaves of a much darker green filled the ceramic pots on the end table and the coffee table and the magazine table. At first I wondered why the room felt so safe. Then I realized it was because there were no windows. The air conditioning made me shiver. I was still wearing Betsy's white blouse and dirndl skirt. They drooped a bit now, as I hadn't washed them in my 3 weeks at home. The sweaty cotton gave off a sour but friendly smell. I hadn't washed my hair for 3 weeks either. I hadn't slept for 7 nights. My mother told me I must have slept. It was impossible not to sleep in all that time. But if I slept, it was with my eyes wide open, for I had followed the green, luminous course of the second hand and the minute hand and the hour hand of the bedside clock through their circles and semicircles every night for 7 nights without missing a second, a minute, or an hour. The reason I hadn't washed my clothes or my hair was because it seemed so silly. I saw the days of the year stretching ahead like a series of bright white boxes, and separating one box from another was sleep, like a black shade. Only for me, the long perspective of shades that set off one box from the next had suddenly snapped up, and I could see day after day after day glaring ahead of me like a white, broad, infinitely desolate avenue. It seemed silly to wash one day when I would only have to wash again the next. It made me tired just to think of it. I wanted to do everything once and for all and be through with it. Dr. Gordon twiddled a silver pencil. "Your mother tells me you are upset." I curled in the cavernous leather chair and faced Dr. Gordon across an acre of highly polished desk. Dr. Gordon waited. He tapped his pencil. Tap, 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 across the neat green field of his blotter. His eyelashes were so long and thick they looked artificial. Black plastic reeds fringing two green glacial pools. Dr. Gordon's features were so perfect he was almost pretty. I hated him the minute I walked in through the door. I imagined a kind, ugly, intuitive man looking up and saying, "Ah," in an encouraging way, as if he could see something I couldn't. And then I would find words to tell him how I was so scared, as if I were being stuffed farther and farther into a black, airless sack with no way out. Then he would lean back in his chair and match the tips of his fingers together in a little steeple and tell me why I couldn't sleep and why I couldn't read and why I couldn't eat and why everything people did seemed so silly because they only died in the end. And then I thought he would help me step by step to be myself again. But Dr. Gordon wasn't like that at all. He was young and good-looking, and I could see right away he was conceited. Dr. Gordon had a photograph on his desk in a silver frame that half-faced him and half-faced my leather chair. It was a family photograph, and it showed a beautiful dark-haired woman who could have been Dr. Gordon's sister, smiling out over the heads of two blonde children. I think one child was a boy and one was a girl, but it may have been that both children were boys or that both were girls. It's hard to tell when children are so small. I think there was also a dog in the picture toward the bottom, a kind of Airedale or a golden retriever, but it may have only been the pattern in the woman's skirt. For some reason, the photograph made me furious. I didn't see why it should be turned half toward me unless Dr. Gordon was trying to show me right away that he was married to some glamorous woman and I'd better not get any funny ideas. Then I thought, how could this Dr. Gordon help me anyway, with a beautiful wife and beautiful children and a beautiful dog haloing him like the angels on a Christmas card? Suppose you try and tell me what you think is wrong. I turned the words over suspiciously, like round, sea-polished pebbles that might suddenly put out a claw and change into something else. What did I think was wrong? That made it sound as if nothing was really wrong. I only thought it was wrong. In a dull, flat voice, to show I was not beguiled by his good looks or his family photograph, I told Dr. Gordon about not sleeping and not eating and not reading. I didn't tell him about the handwriting, which bothered me most of all. That morning, I had tried to write a letter to Doreen, down in West Virginia, asking whether I could come and live with her and maybe get a job at her college waiting on table or something. But when I took up my pen, my hand made big, jerky letters like those of a child, and the lines sloped down the page from left to right almost diagonally, as if they were loops of string lying on the paper and someone had come along and blown them askew. I knew I couldn't send a letter like that, so I tore it up in little pieces and put them in my pocketbook next to my all-purpose compact, in case the psychiatrist asked to see them. But of course Dr. Gordon didn't ask to see them, as I hadn't mentioned them, and I began to feel pleased at my cleverness. I thought, I only need to tell him what I wanted to, and that I could control the picture he had of me by hiding this and revealing that, all the while he thought he was so smart. The whole time I was talking, Dr. Gordon bent his head as if he were praying, and the only noise apart from the dull, flat voice was the tap, tap, tap of Dr. Gordon's pencil at the same point on the green blotter like a stalled walking stick. When I had finished, Dr. Gordon lifted his head. "Where did you say you went to college?" Baffled, I told him. I didn't see where college fitted in. "Oh." Dr. Gordon leaned back in his chair, staring into the air over my shoulder with a reminiscent smile. I thought he was going to tell me his diagnosis, and that perhaps I had judged him too hastily and too unkindly. But he only said, "I remember your college well. I was up there during the war. They had a wax station, didn't they? Or was it waves?" I said I didn't know. "Yes, a wax station, I remember now. I was doctor for the lot, before I was sent overseas. My, they were a pretty bunch of girls. Dr. Gordon laughed. Then, in one smooth move, he rose to his feet and strolled toward me around the corner of his desk. I wasn't sure what he meant to do, so I stood up as well. Dr. Gordon reached for the hand that hung at my right side and shook it. See you next week, then. The full, bosomy elms made a tunnel of shade over the yellow and red brick fronts along Commonwealth Avenue, and a trolley car was threading itself toward Boston down its slim, silver track. I waited for the trolley to pass, then crossed to the gray Chevrolet at the opposite curb. I could see my mother's face, anxious and sallow as a slice of lemon, peering at me through the windshield. Well, what did he say? I pulled the car door shut. It didn't catch. I pushed it out and drew it in again with a dull slam. He said he'll see me next week. My mother sighed. Dr. Gordon costs $25 an hour. Hi there. What's your name? Ellie Higginbottom. The sailor fell into step beside me and I smiled. I thought there must be as many sailors on the common as there were pigeons. They seemed to come out of a dun-colored recruiting house on the far side, with blue and white Join the Navy posters stuck up on billboards round it and all over the inner walls. Where do you come from, Ellie? Chicago. I had never been to Chicago, but I knew one or two boys who went to Chicago University, and it seemed the sort of place where unconventional mixed-up people would come from. You sure are a long way from home. The sailor put his arm around my waist, and for a long time we walked around the common like that, the sailor stroking my hip through the green dirndl skirt and me smiling mysteriously and trying not to say anything that would show I was from Boston and might at any moment meet Mrs. Willard or one of my mother's other friends crossing the common after tea on Beacon Hill or shopping in Filene's basement. I thought if I ever did get to Chicago, I might change my name to Ellie Higginbottom for good. Then nobody would know I had thrown up a scholarship at a big Eastern women's college and mucked up a month in New York and refused a perfectly solid medical student for a husband who would one day be a member of the AMA and earn pots of money. In Chicago, people would take me for what I was. I would be simple Ellie Higginbottom. They wouldn't be after me to read books and write long papers on the twins and James Joyce. And one day I might just marry a virile but tender garage mechanic and have a big cowie family like Dodo Conway, if I happen to feel like it. What do you want to do when you get out of the Navy? I asked the sailor suddenly. It was the longest sentence I had said, and he seemed taken aback. He pushed his white cupcake hat to one side and scratched his head. Well, I don't know, Ellie, he said. I might just go to college on the GI Bill. I paused, then I said suggestively, you ever thought of opening a garage? Nope, said the sailor. Never have. I peered at him from the corner of my eye. He didn't look a day over 16. Do you know how old I am? I said accusingly. The sailor grinned at me. Nope, and I don't care either. It occurred to me this sailor was really remarkably handsome. He looked Nordic and virginal. Now I was simple-minded, it seemed I attracted clean, handsome people. Well, I'm 30, I said, and waited. Gee, Ellie, you don't look it, the sailor squeezed my hip. Then he glanced quickly from left to right. Listen, Ellie, if we go around to those steps over there under the monument, I can kiss you. At that moment, I noticed a brown figure in sensible, flat brown shoes striding across the common in my direction. From the distance, I couldn't make out any features on the dime-sized face, but I knew it was Mrs. Willard. "Could you please tell me the way to the subway?" I said to the sailor in a loud voice. "Huh?" "The subway that goes out to the Deer Island prison." When Mrs. Willard came up, I would have to pretend I was only asking the sailor directions and didn't really know him at all. "Take your hands off me," I said between my teeth. Say, Ellie, what's up? The woman approached and passed by without a look or a nod, and of course it wasn't Mrs. Willard. Mrs. Willard was at her cottage in the Adirondacks. I fixed the woman's receding back with a vengeful stare. Say, Ellie. I thought it was somebody I knew, I said. Some blasted lady from this orphan home in Chicago. The sailor put his arm around me again. You mean you got no mom and no dad, Ellie? No. I let out a tear that seemed ready. It made a little hot track down my cheek. Say, Ellie, don't cry. This lady, was she mean to you? She was awful. The tears came in a rush then, and while the sailor was holding me and patting them dry with a big, clean, white linen handkerchief in the shelter of an American elm, I thought what an awful woman that lady in the brown suit had been, and how she, whether she knew it or not, was responsible for my taking the wrong turn here and the wrong path there, and for everything bad that happened after that. Well, Esther, how do you feel this week? Dr. Gordon cradled his pencil like a slim silver bullet. The same. The same. He quirked an eyebrow as if he didn't believe it. So I told him again, in the same dull, flat voice, only it was angrier this time because he seemed so slow to understand how I hadn't slept for 14 nights and how I couldn't read or write or swallow very well. Dr. Gordon seemed unimpressed. I dug into my pocketbook and found the scraps of my letter to Doreen. I took them out and let them flutter onto Dr. Gordon's immaculate green blotter. They lay there, dumb as daisy petals in a summer meadow. What, I said, do you think of that? I thought Dr. Gordon must immediately see how bad the handwriting was, but he only said, I think I would like to speak to your mother. Do you mind? No, but I didn't like the idea of Dr. Gordon talking to my mother one bit. I thought he might tell her I should be locked up. I picked up every scrap of my letter to Doreen so Dr. Gordon couldn't piece them together and see I was planning to run away, and walked out of his office without another word. I watched my mother grow smaller and smaller until she disappeared into the door of Dr. Gordon's office building. Then I watched her grow larger and larger as she came back to the car. Well, I could tell she'd been crying. My mother didn't look at me. She started the car. Then she said, as we glided under the cool, deep-sea shade of the elms, Dr. Gordon doesn't think you've improved at all. He thinks you should have some shock treatments at his private hospital in Walton. I felt a sharp stab of curiosity, as if I had just read a terrible newspaper headline about somebody else. Does he mean live there? No, my mother said, and her chin quivered. I thought she must be lying. You tell me the truth, I said, or I'll never speak to you again. Don't I always tell you the truth? My mother said, and burst into tears. Suicide saved from seven-story ledge. After 2 hours on a narrow ledge, seven stories above a concrete parking lot and gathered crowds, Mr. George Polucci let himself be helped to safety through a nearby window by Sergeant Will Kilmartin of the Charles Street Police Force. I cracked open a peanut from a 10-cent bag I had bought to feed the pigeons and ate it. It tasted dead, like a bit of old tree bark. I brought the newspaper close up to my eyes to get a better view of George Polucci's face, spotlighted like a three-quarter moon against a vague background of brick and black sky. I felt he had something important to tell me, and whatever it was might just be written on his face. But the smudgy crags of George Polucci's features melted away as I peered at them, and resolved themselves into a regular pattern of dark and light and medium gray dots. The inky black newspaper paragraph didn't tell why Mr. Polucci was on the ledge, or what Sergeant Kilmartin did to him when he finally got him in through the window. The trouble about jumping was that if you didn't pick the right number of stories, you might still be alive when you hit the bottom. I thought seven stories must be a safe distance. I folded the paper and wedged it between the slats of the park bench. It was what my mother called a scandal sheet, full of the local murders and suicides and beatings and robbings, and just about every page had a half-naked lady on it with her breasts surging over the edge of her dress and her legs arranged so you could see to her stocking tops. I didn't know why I had never bought any.